We used to just celebrate today as Palm Sunday. We did all the other stories of Jesus in that last week of his life, the story of the Last Supper on Maundy Thursday, the story of his death on Good Friday, the vigil in the grave on Saturday, and then the glorious resurrection on Sunday. We found that a lot of people's lives have changed and gotten a whole lot busier. And so everybody comes on Palm Sunday, and Jesus is triumphantly entering into Jerusalem. And they come back a week later, and he's died and been raised again. And y'all wonder, how did this happen? So we've changed the way we view Palm Sunday, and we now traditionally celebrate it as Palm Sunday Passion Sunday, from triumphal entry to the death upon the cross. Now, I don't know about you, but for years I wondered how you could go from such a glorious, beautiful celebration, from people waving palm branches and shouting Hosanna, and everyone seeming to recognize who Jesus is as he descends from the Mount of Olives into the city of Jerusalem. How could you go from the crowds praising his name to the cross in so few days? What happened? You almost want to say, what went wrong? And how could it happen so quickly? Well, I want to take you there. And perhaps as we travel the story together, as we enter into the lives and the minds and the places and the culture of the day, when we arrive at the foot of a cross, we'll have a greater sense of not just what happened, but truly how devastating that moment was for all involved. Now, this is going to require that you use some of your imagination. I'm going to invite you to go back in time, nearly 2,000 years, and I want you to pretend, to use your imagination, to see the sights and the sounds of that day. You all are Galileans. You are from the northern regions of Israel. Passover is coming. And it is the celebration of your identity. You're Jews, and Passover is who tells you who you are. You were once nobodies. Slaves in Egypt, disdained, despised, and in bondage. But God set you free through a miracle. Through his might and through his love, he brought you out of Egypt, he freed you from slavery, and he gave you the promised land. You are his people, and he is your God. And you are going to get to do something wonderful this year. You are going to get to celebrate your independence, your national identity, your love of God in Jerusalem. Because this year, you're making the pilgrimage. Other years, persons have gone and you have wanted to go. But this year, you're going. You're in the group that's traveling to Jerusalem. Now, you're definitely going to be traveling in a group because you're going to be going down some dangerous roads. And it is never safe to travel alone due to robbers and bandits and elements and other great dangers. And as you travel, you begin to sing the songs of Zion. Perhaps the psalm that we use for our call to worship this morning is on the lips of the travelers. You sing in rounds. You sing in call and response. You share the stories of how God formed you as a nation and set you free. And you talk about how one day, God is going to send a Messiah, an anointed one, one that will be like King David. And he will set you free again. For as you travel down these roads, there are signs everywhere as you are on your independence celebration, as you are traveling to celebrate the freedom you have in God, everywhere, you are reminded that you are not free. And as you are on your way to the Passover to celebrate the Lamb that God has given you, everywhere, you are reminded that there are occupiers afoot. They have occupied your land, and they have made you prisoners in your own homes, in your own land. You are the most taxed people there have ever been in history. And every time you cross the border out of Galilee, taxes please. You cross the border over into Samaria, taxes please. No matter where you go, no matter where you walk, tolls and taxes. Oh, and these taxes are fun. It's not like there's a list that's been sent out and says, 25 cents to go here, 30 cents to go there. No. The tax collector gets to set the rate. The tax collector, the one who works for Rome. The one who's sending all of your hard-earned money to the enemy. The one occupying your land. The one keeping you from being free. With every step of this journey, you begin to anticipate more and more the coming of the Messiah. With every mile, the stories, the songs, and the taxes make you more and more determined to see God set you free. And more determined that God can do this. The Messiah will come. The journey to Passover is a journey towards expectation. It's a journey towards dreaming of a day when the anointed will come. And Israel will be like old. Oh! And they start to tell the stories. When David was king. When Solomon was king. When we were a great nation and rich. And the nations came to us. And they'll say, you know what the scripture says? It's going to be like that again. The nations will come to us and they will bow down to us and they will honor us. And we will once again be great. And we will once again be free. The journey's been long. Your expectations are high. And you see Bethpage, and it might as well say city limits of Jerusalem. And you start up the Mount of Olives. And you crest the hill. And all of Jerusalem lays before you. And you're ready for the most magnificent sight of your life. The Temple Mount. The place of God. The highest place in the city. And yet when you come to the edge of the ridge of the Mount of Olives and you look out, your stomach turns. And the hair on the back of your neck stands up in that prickly sort of way. And something in you wells up and says, no, it just can't be. This vision, this view that you've waited to see on this great day leading to Passover. You look out, and your beautiful city is marred. Marred by this gigantic, huge, ugly building that actually stands higher than the temple. The Roman garrison. They can't even honor your traditions by letting it be just a little bit shorter. And as you stand there in disbelief of what everything's come to, you start to hear something behind you. Something's happening. People are beginning to get excited and to shout. And you turn around. And you ask, what is going on? And they say, this man, he got on a donkey at Bethpage. And you know what it means. You know the prophecies. You know that is the sign of the Messiah. And everyone gets excited. They don't care if it's the real Messiah or the fake Messiah or the Messiah for today or the Messiah forever. Somebody is daring to stand up in the face of Rome, and you're going to be a part of it. Now, in John's Gospel, it talks about the fact that they grabbed not just their cloaks and branches, but palm branches. You see, you have a national symbol of Israel, and it's the palm tree. And the national symbol of Israel is to wave a palm branch. You might as well have all gotten out American flags on the 4th of July while you're being occupied by Russia. You have just declared who you are and who you want to be. Oh my gosh, you're excited. And the disciples, those closest to Jesus who've made this trip with him, you think the crowd's excited. Boy, are you guys excited. You have been waiting because you know this is no act of, hey, we're going to thumb our nose at the Romans. You know what this is because you know this is the real Messiah. And you have been waiting and waiting and waiting for him to declare his messiahship publicly. And so y'all start knocking each other at the elbows. Ooh, look, it's going to be great. He's finally going to let his hour come. He's finally going to declare his kingdom here on earth. Now, Jesus has been talking about his death, but y'all don't get that nor care because that's ridiculous. He's the Messiah. He's not going to die in the great big battle that's going to kick all the Romans out. Y'all see to that. The Pharisees. Now, the Pharisees don't have quite the same response. Do you notice? They're starting to get scared. And they're starting to say things like, Jesus, you know, cool it down here. Cool it down here. Do you hear what they're saying? The Pharisees probably had several things in mind. One was the Romans are going to hear it. And don't think for a minute just because they're just innocent little palm branches, the Romans don't know what they mean. Don't think for the moment that the Romans have gotten to be the mighty empire that they are by ignoring the culture of the people they've conquered. Oh, they know. They know exactly what Passover is, and they have more Romans stationed in Jerusalem than at any other time of the year. You go to the temple, there's one behind every other pillar of the big Solomon's portico that goes around. They know, and they're ready. That's why one of the Gospels tells us, as the crowd singing Hosanna gets close to the temple, the adults drop out. And the children pick up the tune. It was safer. They weren't going to go after the kids. It was going to look a whole lot better. It's a glorious day. Everyone thinks something great has happened. Jesus pulls his disciples aside and says, I want to celebrate with you the Passover meal. And they all gather together in an upper room, just the 12 of them and Jesus. The disciples are probably thinking this is going to be the big strategy meeting. Jesus says his hour is about to come. Well, this is going to be the big strategy meeting to just figure out exactly how they are going to go from being this little band of followers of Jesus to bringing Israel back to its former glory, to bringing it back to independence, to bringing it back to being a nation that follows after the heart of God. There's another strategy meeting going on this night, or a few nights before that, and that's the strategy meeting of the chief priests and leaders. Now, you all may think that us chief priests were just trying to squelch something because it was going to take away from our glory. But let me tell you, this is not the first Palm Sunday we've seen. We know how it starts. It's just like that Lost World thing where, you know, they see the dinosaurs. Oh, it starts with ooing and awing. But let me tell you how it ends. It ends with screaming and bloodshed and death. And we've seen it happen over and over. Oh, y'all get all excited about some rebel. And next thing we know, we've got a bloodbath on our hands. And at some point, the Romans are going to get so sick of this that they are going to come in and crush us completely. If you think the high priests were nuts, just advance it a few years in history. In 66 AD, that's exactly what happens. A little group of zealots get the Romans all upset with yet another rebellion. And this time, the Romans come in fast and furious. They destroy the city, they destroy the walls, they destroy the temple. We are just trying to protect you from yourself. We are just trying to keep you from following this nutcase to your own deaths. And we've got a plan. Take out the leader, take out the movement. Caiaphas put it this way, don't you know? It is better for one man to die for the nation, for the people, than for many to die. Hadn't a clue what he was talking about, did he? At the meal, Jesus says something very interesting. He talks about body and blood, but you all are too busy arguing about which one of you is going to have the best position in this new order of things. Because, you know, obviously John's like, I'm his best friend. Look, they even call me the beloved in John's gospel. I'm going to get the best position. James is like, you have got to be kidding. He likes me best. And Peter's like, after all I've done, and remember, my nickname's The Rock. I'm going to get the highest position. And so the arguing starts. And they completely miss what Jesus is doing. Jesus says, I will not drink of this cup again until the coming of the kingdom. Well, they're all like, whoo! That's, you know, that's what you say. That's the challenge. The king lifts the cup before the great battle and says, I will not drink of this again until the battle's over and we are the victors. Jesus tells them something else quite interesting. He says, things are going to change. They're going to get very dangerous. And they're like, but we'll be there with you, Jesus. We're ready to go. We won't abandon you. We'll die for you if we have to. He says, I have told you when you go out, don't take a purse, don't take a cloak, don't take a staff, don't take a sword. I'm telling you now, you're going to need all that stuff. Oh, the disciples get excited. And they pull out, they say, we've got two swords right here. We're ready to do battle, Jesus. And he says, that's enough. Enough? Enough to kick the entire Roman legion out of Jerusalem? Enough to bring true worship back to the temple? Two swords? Whew! What he did with loaves and fishes is about to happen again. Then Jesus does what is traditional for Jesus to do. He goes out to pray. It says it was when he was in Jerusalem, that's where he went, the Mount of Olives, to pray every night. Everybody knew it, including Judas. And he had told the right people. So Jesus is out praying on the Mount of Olives, trying to get his disciples to understand what is going to happen. You're all taking a good nap because you know the action is going to come and you want to be well rested. I mean, you know, you don't know what he's up to, but you're ready for a fight. And up comes this crowd with clubs and swords. Now, y'all are ready for this. One person gets out their sword immediately, and they use broad, and y'all use broad swords. That's what you use. So you grab both with both hands, raise it over your head, and nail them right on top of the head. It's not a pretty sight, but that's how you do battle with a sword. Now, Peter, you might be a good fisherman, but you aren't a very good swordsman. I mean, you miss by a lot. You take off an ear and do it so poorly you don't even seem to damage the guy's shoulder. I mean, it's got to be the worst sword fight ever. And to your utter amazement, rather than Jesus jumping into the fray and taking out the high priest and declaring the day his, he stops everything. No, 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 we're not going to do it this way. And he picks up the ear and he puts it back on. In Matthew's gospel, he finishes it by saying, now look, if I wanted to call down God's legions of angels, don't you think I could? perhaps some of the disciples are going, oh, okay, that's how we're going to do it. We're just going to wait till we're in a more public setting. The angels are going to come. It's all going to happen. It's going to be supernatural. No one will be in denial then. Ooh, we can't wait. But nothing seems to go right the rest of the day. Everywhere you go, you follow secretly, quietly, keeping your distance. Jesus doesn't defend himself. Jesus doesn't even tell him really who he is. No matter what court he's in front of, no matter what opportunity he gets, he does nothing. Nothing! Is this Jesus? You've gotten used to the man who can walk on water, who can calm the seas and the winds. You've gotten used to the man who can take loaves and fish and feed 5,000. So who is this who's doing absolutely nothing when he could do anything? You keep holding out hope. You keep wondering what's going on. Peter has a really rough time with it. All your hopes and dreams, for those of you who've been following Jesus closely, all of your hopes and dreams, everything you've wanted for Israel, everything you've wanted for your families, everything you thought God wanted for you, tied up in this man. This man who was the Messiah, who was going to change the world. He would be a great king and a great man. And Israel would be greater than the days of Solomon and David. He gave up everything to follow him. Everything. And he had promised you'd be rewarded for it. You can almost understand why Peter, who was ready to die for this man, is now standing in the shadows saying, I have no clue who he is. I don't know what's going on. I don't understand. Finally, all hope is lost. He carries his cross to Golgotha, the hill of the skull. And there he's put to death in the most painful, cruel, torturous way they had at the time. Oh, crucifixion wasn't supposed to kill you. It was supposed to just make sure you died painfully and slowly. Typically, they just tied you on the cross with rope. But they shoved nails through his wrist and nails through his ankles or feet. When they hoist you up on the cross, you don't die from the blood. They make sure that the foot stand that you stand on is just low enough that you cannot breathe because your lungs are sunk down and that you must push yourself up for every breath. They put you out in the elements where if you don't die from suffocation, you'll die from exposure. And they make sure you're naked so that you're humiliated. And they do it where everyone can see you. Crucifixion is such a horrible death that even the scriptures talk about persons, anyone who dies in that manner is cursed. Because who else would be put to death in such a horrible manner? Jesus' acquaintance stand far off and watch in bewilderment, in shame, and in despair. Every hope they've had for Israel, every hope they've had for themselves, every dream they thought they shared has just died on the cross. It's over. Maybe, just maybe, he wasn't who they thought he was. Now, we are very, very fortunate in that we know how the story ends. We don't have to spend the next week in despair until we get to Easter. We know that while every dream for Israel died on that cross, every hope would be raised. You all would have been sitting there saying, why throw away the opportunity to be the best king that Israel ever had? Why throw it away? To be the eternal king of the whole world. Why throw away saving Israel from the Romans? Save the whole world from something nastier, our own selves. I hope that as Holy Week goes on, that you will take time to read the scriptures. You can begin to pick up in Luke 22 much of what happens, and we hope that you will take advantage of the opportunities that are available this week. And I hope that you will go there to the foot of the cross and allow it all to sink in. Our last hymn is 228. Were you there?